Hello and welcome to Bustles and Broadswords. This is a podcast about women with swords throughout history, fiction, and the queer territory in between. And today's story is a story of a woman who navigated her identity in the most personal and the most public of spaces, like you navigate an everlasting duel, with feints, parries, and a biting riposte. It's an April morning in 1787, pale rays piercing through an ornate room at Carlton House in the heart of London. She steps out amidst a murmuring crowd, the folds of her black dress flouncing around her, sword at the ready. Her eyes flash with sharp confidence while observing the room rumbling with rumours, before her salute. Every lunge and sidestep, every successful parade, becomes a dance with her opponent, anticipating perhaps familiar moves. After all, they have fenced together in the past. And this is a duel, certainly. But first and foremost, it's a performance, where her name and her opponent's are the main attraction as the talk of Europe, speculating over this duelist's many achievements, and her own. One of which is a cross shining sharply against the dark of her dress as she goes in for another lunge. As a champion swordswoman, spy, and source of much speculation, her identities are multiple, intentionally ambiguous and ever-shifting because she wanted them so, before being immortalised within queer and trans history, and possibly, just possibly, within a now lost opera. This is The Chevalière d'Eon. And since this title is the one she fought hard to obtain in many different ways, it's the one we'll use throughout this episode. Although she first had the family name of de Beaumont, when she was born in the town of Tonnerre in the south of France in October 1728, in a region known for its fine wines. I'm not just saying that because I'm French and enjoy a nice glass of red, it becomes relevant later, I promise. And as an added dash of aristocratic extra, our future duelist and current baby is given not two, not three, but six names. Talk about doing the most, which Dion ends up doing. The most, that is. An overachiever in all things languages and literature, alongside studying the blade, she's, well, simply put, a massive nerd, who soon moves to Paris to keep on studying, and by the age of 21, graduated in civil law and canon law. And if, like me, you thought canon law meant being able to declare that your favourite couple on that TV show you like is legit, well, no. It's all about regulations made by church leadership for the government of Christian organisations. Dion ends up with a job that sounds just as thrilling as her studies at the Fiscal Department of Paris. After all, there's no accounting for taste. She pursues work as a royal censor, and is lucky I didn't censor this part of the narrative. Okay, last one, I promise, no more digs at accountants, but just think. Next time you have to do an Excel spreadsheet, tell yourself, Dion would have loved this. Thankfully, outside of her classes and job, Dion still had time to take part in a far more adrenaline-inducing activity. Early on as a child, after all, Dion learned how to sword fight. No doubt to polish this sword skill, she would go to one of Paris's fencing salles d'armes, which literally means a room of weapons, aka my kind of room. And maybe in one of these salles d'armes might have met a certain teenager. The same teenager who, by then, had already duelled a fencing master twice his age with double the experience, who had insulted him with a racist slur, and won that duel, already establishing himself at the age of 16, as an incredible fencer. This is Joseph Boulogne, and we've actually already met him in the future, when he had become the Chevalier de Saint-Georges, dueling en chevalière at Carlton House. But just like Dion, who would still be known as de Beaumont at the time which they first met, this was not a title he yet had. And it was one that, as a black man in 18th century France, he fought hard for. A heads up here over the next few minutes for accounts of sexual violence in the context of the slave trade. The child of Anne Denevaux, a Senegalese woman we know sadly very little about, and of the white plantation owner who enslaved her, Joseph was born in the context of France's wider colonial violence and countless stories of systematized sexual violence, and dropped off away from his native Guadeloupe in a French boarding school at 7, alone, until his mother could join him years later, Joseph continued to suffer the consequences of racist and specifically anti-black laws that meant that he'd have no claim to his father's noble title. By the time Dion met him, Joseph was not only a talented fencer, but a genius violin player and composer. But Joseph's story is not one of a man who fought against the odds to survive within the so-called France of the Enlightenment, aka the age of white philosophers blabbing on about reason while being racist bigots. His story would become one of collective activism, joining the efforts of black people within and beyond Europe, fighting for their autonomy and freedom within the movement for the abolition of slavery. As the countdown to a certain revolution, decade by decade, ticks nearer and nearer, we'll meet Joseph Bologne again. But while his career was laid out before him, Dion's was about to go through an abrupt change. When the foreign ministry turns up on her doorstep in 1753 and goes, "Hey, you, yes, you, want to join the Secret Service?" This is 18th century France's version of MI6, the secret du roi, the secret of the king, king's secret, if you will, like Victoria's Secret, but with more political intrigue and just as many frills. The king's secret was a network of spies that worked in the best interests of the king, taken to an extreme. That is to say, not for king and country, just king. Only king, no country. So Dion accepts to still be an accountant by daylight, but secretly do a bunch of very morally dubious reporting for the king by moonlight. After all, nobody asks you questions when you say you're an accountant. Which is how our plucky young spy in her early 20s is then sent on an international mission to Russia. Not as herself, which to be fair is spy 101 stuff, but to crank it up a notch, not as a gender she was presenting as socially at the time. Because while, according to some accounts, her disguise was under another name, as the secretary of the ambassador to Russia, other versions say this mission had Dion have to be a lady in waiting. The rationale of a spy in skirts, in some versions, was that where male diplomats had failed to improve French relationships with Russia, and as a bonus, sabotage its love affair with England, because hey, historical France and England are like chalk and cheese, maybe a lady would succeed. And the foreign ministry and king only saw one person fit for the job, their new recruit. Now, at the time, Dion would have presented to everyone socially as a man, regardless of how she actually felt about her gender at the time. But beyond the different versions that alleged that she may have worn dresses before, she cuts a conventionally androgynous figure in the eyes of the French Foreign Ministry, and a conventionally feminine and attractive figure, so much so that the ministry asserts in a report that Dion had the sort of legs that were favourable to this disguise, which begs the question of whether this was all an elaborate plan for someone to have it on public record that Dion had really nice legs. I mean, that's why we have archives, really. So in some versions where the lady-in-waiting shenanigans happen, the English influence was apparently so strong that it was tricky to get any Frenchman diplomat over the border. So to avoid too much suspicion, a clueless-looking woman would do the trick. You gotta love sexist Enlightenment rationale. Especially when the very person Dion was meant to influence was none other than another woman, who also happened to have great legs documented by her peers. As we search for her on the grounds of her palace, we may spot a tall and powerful silhouette, cutting a dashing figure in her riding clothes and their distinctly masculine cut. The shotgun's intricate mother-of-pearl decorations undercut the violence of the killing instrument. Frolicking fauna and flora, and, like a secret in plain sight, Diana, goddess of the hunt. And just like the chaste goddess Diana hunted with her woodland nymphs, she also frolicked with them well away from the interventions of men. Simply put, Diana and her forest gal pals were gay as hell. Was the owner of the shotgun aware of this when she commissioned a full garniture of assorted weaponry and accessory centering the goddess? Or was it a thematic coincidence? She certainly was knowledgeable enough as a scholar to understand and yet appreciate a cheeky little double entendre. Because this is Empress Elizabeth Petrovna I of Russia. At the head of the Russian Empire and a glittering court that rivaled the splendor of all other European courts. She spared no expense and no extravagance. So, as she strode back to the palace and settled in her rooms of silver and gold, nibbling at a slice of pineapple, yes, she was pineapples imported to Russia in the 18th century, Rich. She may have been called in to be introduced to a new French person freshly arrived at court, who gazed upon the Empress with her so often described bright blue eyes and fresh, barely powdered face, adorned in the latest fashions from the French court, who curtsied with a smile before introducing herself as Leah de Beaumont. Here, versions blend and merge, exactly as a spy like Dion would have wanted them to, which is why our protagonist intentionally stirs the pot of historical ambiguity and makes it a very spicy brew, in more ways than one. In some versions, this lady-in-waiting remains, in the Empress's eyes, Leah. In others, Dion asks for a private interview with the Empress and reveals herself as the envoy of King Louis XV of France himself, as well as, well, not Leah. At which point, Elizabeth is so taken with this gender mess around that she plays along with the idea of appointing her as a lady-in-waiting to keep up appearances. And it isn't impossible to believe Elizabeth was taken in by this double revelation. If we go was that version of her story. Because within the very first week of Dion arriving at court, our spy would have perhaps been treated to what the court did every Tuesday evening in Elizabeth's smaller gathering before her large 800 guest strong shindig later in the week, engaged in some gender punkery, 18th century style. As Dion entered the ballroom that evening, she maybe would have been back in her usual menswear, but joining her would have been all the ladies of the court, in breeches, tights and jackets, and the men in the dresses and ruffles usually reserved for court ladies. Because this was not just any ball at the Russian court. It was the Metamorphosis Ball. And amongst them, reigning supreme, the Empress herself. Perhaps not all of her courtiers liked the outfit swap, but she was perfectly in her element. In tight trousers that showed off her legs, and for some at the time, maybe the very reason she enjoyed throwing those balls in the first place. Hey, she's got nice legs, flaunt them. Dion was there, in the midst of this world in which the mirror was flipped and appearances were turned upside down. Joyously, chaotically, at the whim of an empress, but within the conventions of the masquerade ball, in which everyday rules no longer applied, and in which each guest could mock the gender roles they were usually assigned to, and challenge these roles in the process. The notable exception of this ball? nobody wore masks to it. Who you were and the gender roles you were breaking were evident. No place to hide, but no need to hide either. It's hard to know if this was a light bulb moment in the dizzying, glittering public spectacle of a ball for Dion. In many ways, it's too convenient, too romanticized, and follows the idea that coming out to yourself and others is a public moment in a prescribed journey, rather than a process that differs from person to person. But did the dashing Empress know and maybe even share some of Dion's gender feelings on a polar opposite spectrum as she danced gracefully around in her men's breeches? I would like to imagine so, and leave that imagination and interpretation as one parallel idea and identity amongst many others, and that whether or not Dion made her identity visible to Elizabeth, she engaged in a solidarity outside the ballroom that made the spy's 5 years at the Russian court a time of early experimentation and freedom. When Dion left, she brought the persona of Leah, her sister self, with her. And in many versions, both her publicly visible self as Leah's brother and her dress-wearing self as her sister would return to the court of Russia in a game of mirrors. Leah at court and her brother at the French embassy. But before that point, it was time for another chapter. Foreshadowed at the ball itself as the Empress entered the room, dressed from head to toe in the outfit of a Cossack soldier. Because while Elizabeth played the role of a warrior for one night only, Dion would soon become one on the battlefield. In some versions, this return to France in 1761 is due to Dion's mission being done. And in other versions, due to the worry that her spying and skirts shenanigans may be in danger of being uncovered. But she was probably not too torn up about this, due to the fact that she received a generous annual pension for her troubles, as well as a position as captain of an elite squad of soldiers, going from drag balls at court to dragoon battalions at war. Dion may have been nervous about suddenly being thrown into the fray of battle, or actually raring to go as a trained rider and sword fighter after years of books, accountancy and assorted frolicking at court. By that point, this was the very end of the Seven-Year War, which had been raging on for, well, you do the math. And Dion did kind of get in on the action at the last minute, but not without taking part in her very first battle, in which Dion apparently fought very skillfully, but she was injured in the thigh and head, and soon had to retire from the battlefield to rejoin the world of diplomacy and negotiation, in which she also was a fierce fighter. Which is why, in 1762, the king sends her on another mission, Destination London, where one version has our spy don dresses again and chat up a British soldier to get him drunk and nick some official military papers. Who knows what really happened? But yet again, Dion very cheekily lets it all up to speculation. We have women embellishing their own stories, and we have women trying to prevent this embellishment from overshadowing their actual confirmed achievements. Then we have a spy hell-bent on making her identity, appearance, and achievements intentionally ambiguous, smiling sweetly at historians of the future like me, and choosing chaos. But what we do know is that when the peace treaty to end the war was signed a year later, she was there. And for all her exploits on and off the battlefield in ending the war, was awarded the Cross of Saint-Louis. And this is also the moment she was awarded the title that she would also proudly display her whole life. That of the Chevalier Dion. Sent back to London, the freshly minted Dion was now working at the British court as a new French ambassador. However, her days as a spy were far from over. In fact, the secret of the king kicked things into high gear again, as the king entrusted her with a top secret mission: to find out information about the state of the British armies and coastal defences in a ploy for a potential invasion. But in the meantime, Dion was actually having a blast with the British, and for Frenchie to admit that, it must have been really fun. She was at the heart of London, with a generous salary and an obligation to network as much as possible. And this brought her to some high places, including the confidence of Queen Charlotte herself. And just like some queer rumours followed Dion and Empress Elizabeth during those 5 years in Russia, was there some will they, won't they with the Queen? There might have been. Even though Dion was immersed in the queer culture of London, its gay molly houses, spectacle and intrigue, it's not clear how much she actively participated in that culture, and seems to have at least shaped her public persona to be more asexual, devoid of sexual attraction. But hey, a rumour's a rumour, and Dion loved a good rumour. Also, not all asexuals are aromantic, which is the absence of romantic attraction. Who knows, maybe she enjoyed a platonic queer snuggle with a queen or two, as well as some gender shenanigans. Because in London, guess who's back? Yes, it's Leah. The sister of Dion makes her debut at court, though weirdly enough, never in the same room as her sibling. And she had a fantastic wardrobe to match this joyful display of experimenting with her gender presentation. Almost as fantastic as the wine that Dion imported from her region and her own home estate to offer to the people she wanted to rub shoulders with. I told you that wine would come back in this story. So by all accounts, Dion is living her best life in London. But, and this is maybe painfully relatable to fellow Londoners in the 21st century, it was all very expensive. Embarrassingly, for a former accountant, Dion was accumulating quite a lot of debt. And the pricey imported wine didn't help, nor the dresses, sure, but neither did her massive library. Relatable? Yeah, kind of. Which is when she started, you know, being a bit of a rascal. The best ladies on this podcast are. If you remember the literal arsonists and violent exhibitionists that we have covered, or I guess uncovered, because she thought to herself, oh hey, that's right, the king asked me to, you know, potentially compromise peace by asking me to spy on the British, including a scheme around a potential invasion. And it would be such a shame if I started collecting receipts just to make sure I have plan B if this all backfires. Oops, there goes that document. Oh no, I did it again, and again, and again. And that's probably some good timing, as the king soon sends through a new ambassador take over from Dion, the Count of Guerchy. And the fact they didn't like each other was a bit of an understatement. Dion dramatically wrote to the king several times that she was convinced Guerchy had tried to spike her drink with opium to throw her into the River Thames. You know, normal work-colleague rivalry stuff. And not only that, she was straight out refusing to leave England, as ordered via an official extradition. But her French pension had been stopped. And despite the English loving her bravado and hating Guerchy, the tides were turning for the once hero of the Seven-Year War. She had to think fast. Dion published almost all of the scandalous secret documents she had been holding onto, greatly embarrassing France in the process. But she was still holding on to the real pièce de résistance. That is to say, all the compromising correspondence showing the king's potential plans to invade. The king, fuming, realised that she wasn't bluffing. And 2 tense years after the book was published and became a bestseller, the blackmail actually worked. Dion would stay in London and receive a £12,000 salary to continue her spying shenanigans. But it soon became clear to many that Léa de Beaumont and her sibling were one and the same person, and rumours started to swirl as to her true gender identity, including insults to her face for the dresses and wigs she wore. But the spy and dragoon wasn't going to let those slide. As an insult stings the air, she turns around and faces its instigator, sizing him up with what I can only imagine was a blend of pride, rightful anger, and disdain. She walks up to him and issues a simple challenge, in a language the fencer knows well, that of the sword duel. Maybe a challenge her opponent would have not taken seriously, but he was soon going to. As their blades clashed and slid one against the other, the Chevalier dashed forward after a swift parry, no doubt delivering a sharp, cutting comment to pair perfectly with the graze her sword point had just made. I'd love to think that it equates for whatever the 18th century English equivalent is for, that's what you get for being a transphobic waste of space. Déon was a sharp blade, and she sent these bigots back defeated and filled with regret. Did she fight these duels in dresses, or in the dragoon uniform she still proudly wore? We don't quite know. And it's likely, yet again, that Déon would have revelled in the confusion and chaos. And one day she woke up and thought, how can I really make Europe have a gender crisis today? So she published another hit book that made absolutely everybody lose their minds and actually start betting about what her gender identity was. The London Stock Exchange was actively involved in increasingly ridiculous sums of money, and then was brought to court for an insurance reason relating to one of these extravagant bets. And instead of the court deciding, maybe you shouldn't all have been betting upwards of £300,000 on the matter, they go to Déon and go, hey, so this is really awkward, but we kind of need to know because you're breaking capitalism. Why have a gender reveal for a baby when you could disrupt the stock exchange with the gender of your choice? But in court that day, as witness after witness filed in to confirm that to them, yes, Déon was indeed a woman, Déon herself? Nowhere to be found. Cut to her in France, turning to the camera and declaring, court adjourned, before winking and sipping a glass of wine. Well, not really, but in my imaginary prospective sitcom about Déon's shenanigans, that totally happens. But soon, Déon had other things to focus her attention on. The King of France was dead, and in comes the new king, Louis XVI, who was about to have a lot more concerns in a few years than his sole one for the time being, which was getting Déon's stolen secret documents back. And Déon, now in London, did what Déon honestly kind of does best. Hide in another country and engage in some primo blackmailing. Her messages from London were like, oh shucks Lulu, would be an awful shame if instead I actually revealed that I'm a spy and that your dad used my spying to potentially invade Great Britain. Which of course could backfire horribly, but there was a way out. And negotiation on both ends on a crucial point, and that was Déon's gender. And so, as Déon officially made her way back to France in 1777, aged 49, with all incriminating documents handed over, at least almost all of them, and putting a life of spying behind her, she had a new order set in stone, defining the course of the rest of her life. Because she was, by royal French decree, and quoting from the official document here, hereby commanded to lay aside the uniform of a dragoon, which he had been in the habit of affecting, and resume the garments of her sex, and is forbidden to appear in any part of our kingdom in any other garments than those suitable to a female. And narratives merge and diverge here. One that Déon asserts herself in many versions is that she had always been a woman, dressed as a man. The other is that she openly recognised that despite being assigned male at birth, she wanted to live publicly as a gender of her choice. And yet another is that by royal decree, she needed to choose one gender, and in doing so, one gender presentation, the dress over the dragoon uniform. This narrative is often simplistically used to suggest Dion was forced to live as a woman, which seems to conveniently forget all the ways Dion has gravitated towards her transness for a long, long time, and perfectly collates with the different records that we have of her life in her letters and in her own personal records. And she wouldn't actually let that decree stop her from wearing breeches again. But we'll get to that. For now, to the eyes of the world, she was the Chevalière Dion. And with that came her return to France and her arrival to the court of Versailles, where, after sharing gender-swapping costume party moments in Russia with an empress and being the protagonist of courtly intrigue with a queen in London, she would now present herself in front of another monarch surrounded by her share of myth and speculation, which included sapphic shenanigans. Let's be honest, you've probably heard them before. All about the literal problematic queen and poster child of cottagecore, Queen Marie Antoinette, who must have enjoyed Dion's company as she had an entire wardrobe made for her by Rose Bertin, the same couturière who had designed Marie Antoinette's own lavish dresses. Not only that, but she kept Dion in the spotlight, intent on presenting her everywhere, at Paris and Versailles. And no doubt that Dion, with her many stories and adventures, absolutely fascinated her at Versailles, along with the rest of the court, where there again, perhaps, her path may have crossed with that of the Chevalier de Saint-Georges again, who had become by then a chevalier by becoming an officer of the king's bodyguard a decade prior. And according to his friend Louis Fusy, thanks to his fencing and riding, served as a model to young sportsmen who formed a court around him. Love with women never seemed to outwardly interest the Chevalier much, or was at least something that he greatly distanced himself from in his public image. Nor did he ever marry. So, maybe just a little bit of a queer vibe. Although some theories see him, just as Dion may very well have been, as more of an asexual figure, which may have been an intentional narrative he wished to shape as a man who was both sexualized and directly attacked for his blackness, leading to many angry husbands attacking him and wrongly accusing him of seducing their wives. For Saint-Georges, these attacks are frequent, and his fencing is not just a source of skill, it's a means of survival. At this point, the Chevalier had advanced his career in music and had become a violin-playing, concerto and opera-composing virtuoso, so much so that he had a claim to the position of head of the Royal Opera. But three white women performers wrote to the Queen to say that they wouldn't want to take orders from a black man. Not able to kick up a fuss again for his safety and survival, he withdrew his application to avoid any issues that would embarrass the monarchy. But Marie Antoinette, a few years later, said screw that and creates her own musical programming within her own salon, with her close circle of friends and a few musicians, including Saint-Georges, no doubt accompanying the Queen with his violin while she played the piano. All the same, the French Revolution in those late 1770s years was already brewing. And Saint-Georges himself would have already actively been involved in fighting for the rights of black citizens and the abolition of slavery in French colonies and beyond. In doing so, fighting against the very same white Enlightenment figures we often tout as the proponents of so-called equality between men and women. An equality that, coincidentally, Dion was around that time proposing, when in that year France officially joined the American War of Independence against Britain, Dillon sent her letter to the French Foreign Ministry with her proposal, which amounted to this: that she would be able to don her dragoon's uniform again and be sent to America to fight for France. But not only that. The Chevalier did have on her bookshelves many references to a gender non-conforming warrior woman who donned armour and engaged in battle amidst her male peers, Joan of Arc. But Dillon did not only look up the standalone heroine, engaging in battle as a so-called exception to her gender. She also looked icons lost between history, legends, and the queer territory in between that presented the idea of a collective of warrior women, alongside her books all about women's achievements and fight for their rights, penned by women themselves. Books that presented the idea that women could fight on the same level as a man, and not only that, but fight together. Which is why, when she proposed her plan, she didn't propose she'd go alone, but that she'd go, leading into battle, a battalion of Amazons. To say this proposal backfired was an understatement. It's seen as direct defiance of the king's orders for her to live her life as a woman, because in the gender-conforming eyes of the king and the state, womanhood doesn't include donning men's clothing to fight. To which Dillon was like, screw you, and showed up to court in her uniform anyway. And this gender non-conforming defiance from Dillon as a warrior woman means one thing: a final exile to her hometown, with the threat that she would need to continue wearing women's clothing or else. On the surface, the Chevalier is back where she started, and everything and nothing is the same. She's alone there, in Tonnerre, with her mother. And perhaps at that point, she found the time to reflect on what had brought her to an understanding of who she was. Something that was not in the spotlight of the great courts of Russia, England, and France, nor in the open gossip of the streets of London and Paris, nor in the public testimonies of the trial or the ink of the newspapers speculating on her gender. Not even engraved on the blade of a sword, in letters of gold. Instead, in the quiet contemplation of her own faith. We already know that one Christian figure in her library was a beacon of queer and trans possibility, then and now, armor-bearing, sword-wielding. But to Dillon, so were the trans saints who had lived their lives not in spite of their faith, but fully embracing it as part of their identity. Trans monks who had devoted their lives to Christianity and who had been able to live their truest selves within the confines of a religious space. Just like these figures, Dillon's faith had guided her, not only in understanding her own identity inwardly, as her letters express the notion of her soul and the fact that her God knows who she is, regardless of her physical body and any speculations around it, but the gender presentation she ended up adopting for the rest of her life. In a letter to Madame the Duchess of Montmorency-Bouteville, in 1778, she writes, "Thanks to God, the law, and the king, I no longer fight, either hand to hand or from a distance, since I have begun to wear a dress and have adopted a new body at the Convent of the Virgins of Holy Mary." The meaning of this is strangely ambiguous, and yet alludes to other stories of Dillon wearing dresses long before 1778 and long before the events that had set her identity in stone. Stories of a young woman, decades earlier, wearing dresses at the convent she would visit and enjoying the acceptance she felt there, embraced by her faith and her interpretation of it in her own words. Reminding us that outside of the glitz and glamour, the rumours of London or of the French court, maybe Dillon's true sense of her own self was in the quiet moments she felt within a convent. these moments of quiet were not last, because the clock is striking 12. It's French Revolution time. Just before the revolution struck, a lot had been in flux for Dion. She hadn't been able to just stay put in her town of Tonnerre, and had been able to go back to London by special permission to tie up some loose ends, specifically a library which had bits that interested and concerned the French government. More of those embarrassing documents. France was like, so here's £6,000, just go take care of the library, full of secrets, please, thank you, merci, au revoir. And Dion was like, yeah, so instead of this being a temporary trip, I think I'll just stay here and not cause too much trouble, I guess, I promise. And she also did so publicly as a woman. Her freedom in London would allow her to live on her own terms and negotiate her own relationship to her gender identity and presentation and her gender non-conforming sword-fighting streak. She opened up a fencing school and taught young people as a master of arms, but also took up the practice of fencing for show, challenging champion swordsmen to fight for a captive audience. Never one to not take things further, Dion then toured across the UK putting on those shows. But due to the events of the revolution, well, Dion's pension obviously went straight out the window. Her lands back in Tonnerre were seized by revolutionaries, and she even found herself selling her books and clothing, including that collection of Rose Bertin dresses ordered to her by the Queen. Not that this really seemed to dampen Dion's enthusiasm for championing warrior women, whatever side they were on, because in 1792, she writes to the French National Assembly, put in place during the Revolution, to lead a division of women soldiers against the Habsburgs, aka the very family of Marie Antoinette, who was entangled in the causes of the fall of the French monarchy. And the National Assembly was like, yeah, no. Despite the fact that many women actually did take up arms during the French Revolution. But in the meantime, a year before, a familiar name was amongst those enlisted in the Revolutionary Army. That very same year, the rumble of a light cavalry troop had a familiar face at the heart of its creation, part of a troop he formed of volunteers of African and Caribbean descent. First known as the Cavalry of the Americans and of the South, but soon to be known, thanks to the exploits of its founder and leader, as the Légion Saint-Georges. This glory did not last. Imprisoned for pissing off whoever was in charge of the musical chairs of revolutionary leaders, his pardoning came 2 years later, in 1794, the same year as the official abolition of slavery. No longer allowed to rejoin the army, Saint-Georges attempted to patch together his musical career, but this proved a lot harder than expected without the usual backing he had by the nobility, which is why one of his last operas dated from years ago, after a certain event may have inspired it. And this brings us back to that day in Carlton House. The Chevalier against the Chevalier. Despite the age that separates them, Dion is still holding her own, with each thrust and parry, before a moment that rips a gasp from the audience. She lunges forwards, surprises him, and lands a hit. Rumours spiral immediately. Did Saint-Georges give this hit to a lady on purpose out of gallantry? Was it due to her age? Joseph only being a young 40 to Dion's late 50s? Well, apparently Dion herself pointed out at her successful first hit, "Come now, sir, you must have allowed me this out of gallantry." Only for Saint-Georges to answer, "Actually, madame, I did everything I could to avoid it." So no animosity, no bloodshed, and no hard feelings. Whoever won, because obviously Saint-Georges biographers will say that he won, and Dion biographers will say that she won, they parted ways with the knowledge that they both had a fair exchange and put on a hell of a show. The show that they had both been accustomed to putting on their whole lives in the public eye, as targets of both admiration and bigotry. And in many ways, the way their paths crossed one last time so flamboyantly and dramatically would signal a point of no return in the coming years. For Saint-Georges, a blaze of glory that saw him abandon music and pour himself into the revolution, and for Dion, after a few more years of fighting, a fencing injury that would leave her dispossessed of her livelihood. Neither of them had a happy end to their lives. Dion spending the last 15 years in poverty, and Saint-Georges dying from an illness after being incapable of stepping back into his fighting days or his composing days. But upon his return to Paris, the year of that fateful performance duel, Saint-Georges produced an opera called La Fille Garçon, The Girl Boy. It may have, if the title is anything to go by, embraced the popular image of a gloriously heroic and ambiguous woman who chose to dress in men's clothing and take up a sword, and who, for that very reason, was often at odds between two worlds. A figure that would have been a subject of fascination and fear alike, showing new feminist queer possibility, and in doing so, threatening the status quo. The opera was a comedy, yet it may have wanted to translate an underlying truth beneath the laughter about the way the boundaries of gender had by that time stretched and shattered beyond the surface-level idea of bustles and breeches. I couldn't resist. Did Saint-Georges draw inspiration from the life of his friend and one-time opponent, who had embraced womanhood and yet had not wanted to reject the so-called masculine sword-fighting and soldier's uniform, who embraced both her present and past selves, who had found herself between public and private spaces, between the ball and the convent, in between the expectations of gender that she fought to transcend? We'll never know for sure, because this opera is lost to time. A lot of Saint-Georges' work was forgotten and discarded for a long time. It's only been a few decades since it has properly been appreciated again, and not only that, but played. But as we rediscover Saint-Georges, we can take some solace in his absence, because it allows us to construct our own opera of La Fille Garçon, one of parallel versions and interpretations soaring and uniting, of blades raised in defiance of gender norms, and vibrant queer and trans history as the curtain falls, an opera worthy of the Chevalier Dion and all of our shared histories. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can access the images referred to, show notes and transcript for this episode via the link in the description. If you have a story about a sword lady, real or fictional, or maybe a bit of both that you'd like to tell me about or ask questions about, write in at bustlesandbroadswords@gmail.com. In the meantime, you can follow the podcast at Bustle Sword Pod on social media. You can find me on most social media platforms, trying to procrastinate from writing, narrating, and producing this podcast at Carmine Claire. Stay safe, sword lady lovers, and see you in a future episode. En garde!